Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate.
Hi, welcome to our very first show of Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, and let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm a pediatric speech-language pathologist, and I work with babies and toddlers and even young preschoolers who are having difficulty learning to communicate. I've been a speech-language pathologist for 15 years and in private practice for the last 10 years or so, and in January of this year, I launched a website called teachmetotalk.com. The success of that site is what prompted us to launch this show. My co-host is my very good friend and colleague, Kate Hensler. Kate, are you there?
I'm here.
Yay!
Oh, boy, it's official. Yes, my name is Kate Hensler, and I am called a developmental interventionist. And it's always kind of a funny thing to say because nobody quite seems to understand what that means. But in my case, my educational background includes an undergraduate degree in psychology, a bachelor in science of nursing, and a master's in interdisciplinary early childhood education. And I've worked for First Steps for the last 10 years, started as a service coordinator, and for the last 8 years have been a developmental interventionist or a therapist, depending on which state I happen to be working in. And, to say what that means, truth is I do a lot of focusing on speech and language development, although I don't have that educational background. I also work on cognitive skills and social skills, self-help skills,
but
pretty
you're
much.
You're really a closet speech therapist.
That's really what I really am, yes. I didn't know if I wanted to say that on air, but truth is I am.
Sorry.
Secret's out.
All right, let me go ahead and give out our guest call-in number. It's 718-766-4332. And as you can tell, Kate and I are very, very, very informal. And we want this show to be not unlike the telephone conversations that we've had every day for the last 10 years, where we talk about kids and talk about what we're seeing and what we're doing that works and what doesn't work, or any questions that anybody might have. Is that fair to say, Kate?
I think that's reasonable.
Okay, good deal. Well, let's.
We might not want to do the complaint department on air, but other than that, I think we're good.
Oh, complaint department is a whole different show. We'll
that's
talk about
true.
That later. All right.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about the comment that I got on the website from the mom with a 25-month-old toddler who was diagnosed with apraxia. Remember
mm-hmm.
that comment? Okay. I'm going to read it so that I can refresh your memory. Okay, here goes. Hi, I have a 25-month-old toddler who was diagnosed with verbal apraxia. The therapist who initially evaluated him moved to another state, and then I was assigned another speech pathologist. My son can say two words correctly pronounced with four additional word approximations. I'm extremely concerned because the speech therapist told me during her third therapy session with him that he's already two, which is a big boy according to her, and then he needs to begin expressing sentences such as, I want juice, my name is Eric, blah, 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 when he can't say those words alone or in isolation. This mom goes on to say that she told the new speech therapist about the previous diagnosis of apraxia, and the new speech therapist said that it was too early to make a diagnosis. And then this mom goes on to say that her son exhibits all the characteristics of children with apraxia, never babbled as an infant, had some words, juice and ball, when he was 22 months old, but they've never heard them again, repeats some words and sounds, but inconsistently, and he tends to make a lot of errors. He leaves off consonant sounds, he substitutes some sounds, and he's come up with a lot of elaborate hand gestures to represent things that he wants. Sounds like kids we see every day, huh?
It certainly does. And although I'm not technically qualified to say he's apraxic, it sure sounds like he is to me from what the mom has to say about him.
It does to me, too. And she goes on to say that she's tried to express all this to her current therapist, but that, again, the therapist keeps telling her that she has to wait until he's three, but that they have to go on and focus on sentences, because he's going to be so far behind his peers when he gets to preschool. And then the mom ends this with what, oh, just irritated me to no end when I read this on Friday. She says, I just don't know if I'm overreacting. After all, she is the one with the master's degree in speech pathology. Oh, I hate it when I hear that. And so I thought about that all day on Friday, And I talked to you about it, talked to my husband about it, talked to anybody that would listen about it, and then kind of came up with this series of questions about whether bad therapy, if that's even better than no speech therapy at all. And so I want to talk a little bit about that today. But first, I want you to weigh in on what you think about that mom's comment and then about her opinion about that, because I think you have more experience with that than I do with working with a therapist who seems to be off the mark as far as what she should really be working on.
So are you asking whether I think bad therapy is better than no therapy, or are you asking?
Everything. I'm asking everything.
You want my total opinion. Well, of course I'm going to do side on the side of the child does definitely sound like he's a praxic and having
worked with. I think so too.
Working with apraxic kids for many years now. I mean, and having researched and attended lectures and done everything I could do to make myself knowledgeable and functional as far as working with them, I would say, what in the world is she thinking, saying she wants them to say sentences? Of course, I mean, ideally, yeah, I'm sure she does, and so does the mom. But, you know, is he anywhere near ready? Of course not. If you can't say your name, how are you going to say my name is Eric?
Right, and I think that's one thing we should talk about is I feel like, and the research certainly supports this, that when children have a large enough base vocabulary of single words, and typically that's anywhere from 35 to 50 words, that's when phrases start to emerge on their own. So it really doesn't make sense just from a typical development standpoint to even work on phrases, even little two-word phrases, more cookie, bye-bye daddy, until the point that those single words are really solidly within a kid's control. Don't you think so? Have you seen that?
Absolutely. And I would say that all you're doing is setting the stage for that child to fail because he's not at all ready to do that. So why would you start out saying, we're going to ask him to do something he's not nearly capable of doing? I would
Absolutely.
Be thrilled to get ball from him.
Absolutely. The other thing that the mom talks about is that he is not even a consistent imitator yet.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't even have, even at an imitation level, isn't even doing lots of words. And so he certainly is not going to be able to formulate those sentences and say that, especially with a diagnosis like apraxia. Let's talk about those characteristics. I'm going to go ahead and read kind of the standard definition of apraxia, and then let's talk about that. First of all, for parents who don't know, apraxia is a neurological speech condition that affects the child's ability to plan, execute, and sequence the movements of the mouth necessary for intelligible speech. It's most often referred to, you can hear therapists and doctors call it, developmental verbal apraxia, childhood apraxia of speech, verbal dyspraxia, but truth be told, most professionals use those terms kind of interchangeably. In the most technical sense of the word, apraxis means without movement, so apraxia with that prefix for apraxia would mean without movement, and then dyspraxia would mean difficulty with the movement. But don't you think most people just kind of use those terms interchangeably professionally?
Yes, absolutely. I think really I hear apraxia the most, but people seem to know that they're interchangeable.
I think so too, and I do think it's kind of a regional thing. Wherever you went to school, wherever speech pathologists went for their master's programs is probably, you know, how they refer to it.
Right.
I want to go ahead and give the call-in number one more time since our quote-unquote executive producer, also known as my husband, is here pointing at the number. It's 718-766.
Go Johnny.
I know, 4332, 718-766-4332. If anybody out there has a question about apraxia or anything else that Kate and I could help you with. But let's get back to the characteristics of apraxia. Like this mom said about her little guy, limited babbling in infancy, meaning that these babies are really, really quiet. You don't hear a lot of that vocal play that you would typically hear when children, even the oohs and coos that you want to start to hear at about 8 to 10 to 12 weeks, you don't really hear a lot of that. You don't hear a lot of the practicing in the crib, like my, 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 da, 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 ga, 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 ga. And then when other kids start to say words around a year or try to imitate that, those babies, again, tend to be pretty darn quiet. And actually, a big indicator for apraxia is few or no words by 24 months or by two, by that second birthday. And then I think the hallmark of apraxia is just a really poor ability to imitate the sounds and the words, so that when you're sitting there and you've tried 25 times to get them to say a word, there's nothing. Or grunts. Don't you think the it's pretty darn characteristic of kids with apraxia?
Yes. They will try and carry on full conversation with
Yeah.
Then also the big discrepancy in the receptive language skills or what they're able to understand. So in other words, this is the classic apraxic child is the one who knows what you're saying but can't respond at all with words.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing that apraxic kids do, that kids that don't talk for other reasons, which we'll probably talk about on future shows, but they really mess up the vowel sounds in a word as well as the consonant sounds. So instead of trying to say ball, you know, it might just be so that they're missing that B and they're missing the for ball, and that vowel differentiation is there. Or they're so inconsistent, you might hear a word, it might just pop out, which is what Pamela Marcella has termed those words. She's a speech pathologist who is a really has a huge body of treatment information about children becoming verbal with the diagnosis of apraxia, and she calls those pop-out words. So a parent might hear a word one time and then never, ever again. Or the other thing that they do that I think you mentioned before is that they'll say a word and it's so off-target that it's just unrecognizable, and then they're really, really, really inconsistent with it.
Right. And, Laura, haven't you seen, you know, in your experience with working with apraxic kids that, in a way, it makes them really kind of, I don't mean this in a negative way, but really cute, because sometimes they're like, and this, that mom who, you know, sent you that blog or email, I don't know what we would call that appropriately, but on your website, said this, that he uses a lot of natural gestures, and
yeah.
I've noticed that sometimes or frequently apraxic kids, they're almost kind of hyper exaggerated on their facial expressions, and because they can't do anything else, you know, they've learned how to get a lot of meaning across with no words.
I think so too, and they do kind of become champion users of gestures because mm-hmm. they don't have any other way to do it. Yeah,
right.
I see that a lot.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. Thank you.
We'll
Thank you for making
it.
That sound good.
Oh, that was funny. The inconsistency, though, I think is a big hallmark of that diagnosis, though. Sometimes they can say it, sometimes they can't. And then one other big indicator that it might be apraxia is that there usually is a family history of communication difficulty. Don't you get kids whose parents say, well, all the boys in our family talk really, really late.
Mm-hmm.
Or my husband's grandfather really didn't talk well, even as an adult. He really stumbled over words and wasn't a great communicator, those kinds of things. Don't you think you hear that a lot, too?
I do. Another one is the, you said the pop-out words.
Right.
And then, what was my other brilliant idea?
Well, I think one thing they do while you're thinking is they might use one sound for everything, like duh. It means ball.
Right.
It means dada. Mm-hmm. It means dog. It means truck. It means everything, because that's the sound that they can say.
Right, and they look at you like they're saying it, and you're thinking, oh, no, it's still duh. Yeah, or
yeah.
Bah, or whatever their one sound is. Oh, I know, I was going to say something about that inability to imitate, and you know how Pam Marcella, who you referred to, talks about how that just is absent so often in apraxic kids. I've even in the beginning tried to get them to imitate opening their mouths the way I do, imitate sticking their tongue. They can't even do that, let alone get a word out.
You're exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
That whole oral imitation piece is lost. And they might be able to blow out, say, a birthday candle when you put that right in front of their mouth. But if you ask them to blow just in and of itself, they may not be able to do it. And even, and it's so, the first few times you see that with a kid, you think, what is going on? You start to wonder, okay, did they not understand the command? And start really looking for every other reason then. They just do not know how to make their little mouths work that way. And so that's one thing that I think is very interesting for parents to kind of note. And sometimes I think they don't even know that about their kids until we point it out during an assessment. Have you found that to be true?
Frequently. Yeah. It almost would take a mom who's a speech-language pathologist to catch that coming in. They kind of go, oh, yeah, I never noticed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or they'll think, they'll say something like, oh, he just doesn't want to do it right now. Oh, or he's being stubborn.
Yeah. If he wanted to, he would. Yeah. Well, I'm holding a sucker in front of his face. I think he wants it. Yeah. They don't necessarily see that. No, really. And sometimes it is kind of confusing because those kids can kind of, once in a great while, just like a pop-out word, they can pop it out, and you think, well, he did it once, and it's kind of natural to assume that if he does it once, he could do it any number of times that he chose to, but we know from experience that's really not true.
Right.
Like, the stars aligned and it happened once, but that doesn't mean you're going to hear it again in the next 6 months.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And the literature is full of that about kids, too. These are not just things that Kate and I are making up or just things that we've seen forever. This is really documented in the literature about childhood apraxia. There's a great website, apraxia-kids.org, that talks, oh, gosh, I was going to say talks a lot about apraxia, but really it is the standard reference for parents and professionals who suspect or who are working with children with that diagnosis. And then my site, teachmetotalk.com.
I was going to say, don't forget to mention your own site, Laura.
Has a section with completely devoted to apraxia in toddlers. And some speech pathologists are really reluctant, like the comment that we were talking about earlier from the mom on the website, so reluctant to call it what it is because they just get so bogged down in, I guess, one, wanting to rule out everything else before they call it apraxia, or two, not being really sure of their own diagnostic skills so that they feel really uncomfortable making a diagnosis like that. Have you worked with other therapists that you think that's been the case?
Have I? That's the complaint department issue.
Yeah.
One of the many. No, truthfully, I have. And it can be difficult in my position because I don't really have the credentials to say it. And, of course, I never say, your child has this. But if I strongly suspect that this is probably apraxia we're looking at, I say I suspect it could be and then provide them information. But, yes, you know, I might be on a team with a speech therapist, and she never mentions it. She never says anything about it. And I kind of feel like it's only fair and reasonable and really best practice to tell or at least suggest that the mom may want to look into that, may want to become better informed about it, because it really kind of can set the stage for appropriate care if they come in knowing that.
I think so, too. And I think one thing that a lot of therapists do, and it says it in the literature so clearly, that you can use general language facilitation techniques to work with lots of kids with language issues. But kids with apraxia really need some tweaking of those techniques to make those successful. Don't you think so?
I do. I certainly do some things differently than with other kids, but I think your style of therapy really lends itself to apraxic kids because, you know, those pop-out words they get, when I ask parents about, well, when do you hear those? They pretty much universally say, well, it was when he was really excited or when he was really scared or when he was really mad. You know, he said, my ball, or, you know, eat more, eat cookie or whatever it might be. But anyway, there's that heightened arousal level thing going on.
Right.
And because you use that real animated, playful, child-centered, you know, approach to therapy. And I say we because I try and use your approach. You know that very well. But if you get them there kind of emotionally so that they do have a heightened sense of arousal, they're better able to get those pop-out words for you, too. You know, I mean,
I think so, too.
It's like, and I always call it, we've got to get their verbal motor running. You know, they've got to be with you. They've got to be kind of excited. They've got to be having fun, or they're going to look at you with those big eyes and say, forget it.
Yeah.
It's not coming out.
I know, and I do think, and you touched on that, the easiest way to get those is really by play and really not with reading books.
No.
Not with doing flashcards. Really, really age-appropriate fun play. And I do think your phrase, get his motor running, is something I think about all the time when I see those kinds of kids. You know, you have to go in, start out with a big, hey, let's play. Start going through the bag and getting those things that you know that he likes and really get him involved in playing. And you're going to hear those words and, again, get him to the point where he is going to be able, physically even, to imitate those words, because you have to get those little bodies ready as well.
Right.
And I think the best way to do that is by getting that heightened emotional reaction and getting them playing.
Right.
One other thing that I want us to talk about with that's kind of become our standard of treatment with kids with apraxia, and really even kids with language delays, no matter what the issue, is using sign language. Don't you think that's just the best?
I do, and that's another one of those complaint department issues, because I still, even though, you know, for 10 years this has been the standard of care, and yet I still hear other or mothers tell me that other speech therapists say, we don't necessarily want to sign because he might use that instead of words, which I just find utterly ridiculous.
Well, it's just crap, for lack of a better word, because the research tells us that signs really do help children talk faster. And then just from our personal experience, I think if we can go in and give a kid a way to let his mom know what he wants that's not pointing and doing then they learn that whole power of communication, and they learn I can do something, and then I can get something, and my whole world is going to go better if I can make my mom and dad understand what I want. I've used signs, like you said, for at least the past 10 years, and actually I went to a pretty progressive graduate program, and they use signs all the time with kids, so I didn't know any better. Thank goodness. And then when I started working and realized that that was controversial, I couldn't even believe it and thought that those therapists probably had never tried it or they wouldn't feel the way they do, because it is like magic for some kids. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I can't say I've ever heard anybody I thought was very good say it. Let's put it that way. But it's still more, you know, I still can't really believe that people are still out there telling parents that. And to me, it's a stopgap measure to get them communicating, because communicating doesn't necessarily mean talking, although you and I both know that we don't accept those signs for long. We're pushing the words,
well,
but
absolutely.
It does give them some power over their environment, which is hugely important to young kids and toddlers. So
it is huge, but I do think that you can go in and stop a lot of that one initial frustration, because they do learn pretty quickly, oh my gosh, I am going to get more cookies if I put my fingers together right here. Look, that is awesome. Did you see that? I got a cookie just because I put my fingers together. You know, and so I think that it works beautifully. And I think when kids are signing, and the research tells us this is true, they are more apt to start to imitate your words too, because you're pairing a motor movement with a word that you're trying to elicit from them.
Right. And,
so and
we
you,
know
you,
from just doing yeah. it and doing it and doing it that, yeah, it works, and we can pretty much predict which words they're going to be popping out first, because they're those words that we say, let's use this sign and this sign and this sign. And I think you and I both agree that using a real, introducing the initial signs that are real functional, like more and eat and, you know, cookie, whatever it is that child happens to be into, but those words that they can use repeatedly all day long is a great place to start.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of professionals, and I know that the big autism guy, Dr. Carbone, talks about not using a lot of those really general signs,
mm-hmm.
more, please. He talks about not doing that because he wants kids to really follow a specific label, or not to find specific signs that are more noun-like, but I still like those early requesting signs, like the more and the please, because I do think that you can get kids to do them pretty immediately, because, you know, more is putting your fingers together right in front of your body, and please is rubbing your palm on your chest, and I do think they work so well that it is almost more motivating for them to do that at the beginning, because they don't have to learn 5 or 10 signs the first day. You teach
right.
them those two, and their parents can kind of alternate between them and then use those for lots of different kinds of requests. Don't you agree?
I do. Yep. That's what I've done, and I really have not run into issues where they get stuck there. I think you do have to maybe be somewhat aware of that, but, you know, make that part of the plan that you're not going to continue to accept that, and you're going to be mildly encouraging additional signs every time you see them and encouraging the parents and family members to do the same thing. So, you know, just because it's a potential hazard doesn't mean you don't do it because it could cause a problem. The fact is it gets them communicating sooner rather than later, and that's what every parent wants.
Absolutely. There's a list of signs that we teach first on the website at teachmetotalk.com. You can either find it in the apraxia section under the articles with sign language, or there's also a section on sign language. So if any listener wants to take a look at that, that would be a good resource. Let's talk about one more thing really quick for apraxia, too, as far as sounds go, is to elicit sounds. I use those, I just model those a lot in play. Instead of working on really specific, say, sitting and just working on vowel sounds for the sake of doing vowel sounds, I never, ever, ever do that. It's always paired with an action in play. Don't you do the same thing?
Yes. I don't have that. That's even a little too speechy for me. I don't think I'll be doing
You're
that.
You're just going for those words.
That's right. At least some form or approximation of the word. I just think it's so unnatural, you know. I mean, it's
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten a comment about that on the website, which is what made me think about that today. Or actually, I think it was an email for a mom who said that she had a child who saw a therapist through their state's early intervention program. I think she's in Pennsylvania or somewhere like that. And that the therapist who... through early intervention, and I believe it was a speech therapist through that program, really played with him and used lots of toys, and he loved it and had a great time and was making all kinds of progress.
Wait, I want to have to correct you. I think it might have been like the developmental interventionist person.
It might have been.
Because I think I read it, and I think that it said, I don't know if it's the developmental therapist, but maybe just like early interventionist or something.
Maybe it did.
Because some
right.
states kind of have a general person and then, you know, speech therapist or whatever. So I'm sorry, didn't mean to correct you, but I had to get a plug in for the early interventionist folks out there.
Well, this would be like our regular phone conversations, then, wouldn't it, for your jumping in to correct me.
And I have to correct you, yes, every now and again. Okay, finish. I'm sorry.
All right. I'm not even sure what my original point was.
That the first person, whatever discipline she might have been, was really, really playful.
Okay, she really played all the time. He was totally into it. Made lots of initial progress. The mom was thrilled, and this little guy was apraxic and had a diagnosis of autism, too. So a couple different issues going on. But that approach really hooked him and made him want to connect with her and be with her and then learn language. And then he turns 3. She switches him, of course, because after 3, you're not in your state's early intervention program anymore. She found a private speech pathologist who... I can barely even say it. We put him in a chair, put a tray on there, make him name 5 or 6 flashcards, then might reward him with playing with a toy for 10 minutes. And then she would start over. And the mom went on to talk about how he cried and complained and didn't want to do it and just was really, really, really negative. And the mom totally forgot about how the approach had worked, which was... it's so sad for me for that little boy and sad for that therapist, too, because she wasted all that great time. I think you should, first of all, never use flashcards for children who don't absolutely love them and probably for any kid under about 4.
Right.
And secondly, she missed all the opportunities during play. Play was the thing he wanted to do, so she totally missed it, in my opinion.
Yeah, which, you know, sometimes kids who are autistic, I'd say frequently, aren't necessarily good players, and it sounds like he might have been, and so, as you say, what a missed opportunity, because if she'd been down there on the floor with him, laughing and having fun, engaging him, that's when he would have said the words and meant them, as opposed
to
locked in the chair and labeling a picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's not only on the website now. We see it in real life, too.
It's
out there all the time.
And you see it really more than I do, too, because, you know, I'm the speech person on the team, so I don't see that unless it might be an OT or a the DI on teams of kids that I work with that do that, but I think you probably see it a little bit more than I do. But yeah, it's very distressing, and I hope that that's one thing we can address through this, is how to do therapy appropriately with toddlers and young preschoolers and give parents the information so they can make really good informed decisions about the kinds of therapy that they're offering for their children.
Right. Well, I responded to what gave a comment on the one you got from the lady who, Inez or something like that, who
right, I read that, yeah.
Child had apraxia and then therapist moved, got a new one, and she didn't think she was, you know, where she was doing
yeah,
the very structured, inappropriate stuff. And my comment, and I don't always have the nerve to say this to live families, but I hear it, you know, so often.
Easy of the internet, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it's easy on the internet, which is kind of nice. But, you know, parents tell me a lot, and I know you hear it some, but usually it happens to be with this. I see a lot of speech-type kids. You know, they may have cognitive issues, but they almost always have language issues. And they're saying, he doesn't talk for her. He doesn't like her. He cries when she comes. He, just as that mother described. And, you know, you want to say, look, you know your child. What do you think he's telling you?
Right.
You know, if he's crying and upset and running and fussing and throwing things at her and whatever else, they have their ways. If they don't have one word, it's usually pretty easy to know what a frustrated two-year-old means, you know.
Well,
I mean,
they're communicating it, and why I don't understand how therapists don't get that, how they don't understand this kid hates
is miserable.
Yeah. Yeah, this kid sees me coming and runs.
And there cries.
And cries, and I don't know why they think it's therapeutic to hold a kid down and make them do things that they obviously don't want to do. And, you know, it's just totally inappropriate. And I don't think that they're ever going to get anything near what they would get from the kids that they really follow their lead, that they play, and they make it fun, so that the kid wants to do it and it actually becomes something they look forward to rather than something that they flee from.
Right. Well, I don't even know that that's unique to two-year-olds or young children. I mean, I feel like I do my best work when I'm happy, when I'm motivated,
absolutely,
when I like the person I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
If you're miserable and bored or frustrated, you kind of say, forget it, this isn't worth it. So that's just kind of human nature, and somehow we, or shouldn't, maybe we, but, you know, therapists forget it. And it's just like, well,
yeah,
how could you think that was therapeutic? One time I had a little overlap with a therapist, and she was forcing this child to try and name farm animals, which isn't a horrible thing, but he couldn't have cared less at the moment.
Right.
And he was crying, and he was throwing a fit, and she looked over to the mother and said, it's okay if he's crying. He's still learning. And
oh,
I
my
thought,
God.
Oh.
I totally disagree with that. I do not think when you're crying and rolling around on the floor that any learning is going on, other than I hate you, lady, and I never want you to come back to my house again, and please can't my mommy look at me and get you out of here. You
yeah,
are no fun, and I never want to see you again.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what kids learn, or they learn this person is mean and doesn't respond to me. This person doesn't read my cues at all. This is awful for me. This is horrible.
Yep, here I am locked in this body, can't get a word out, and this woman is completely out to lunch as to what I'm trying to tell her. And, you know, I think most five-year-olds could interpret a two-year-old fit as being, he
right,
doesn't like it. He's not happy.
Right.
He wants to get out of this room. I mean, it's fairly obvious, but somehow they convince themselves that he's learning, you know.
Yeah. And I think that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah, it doesn't
really
look like learning to me.
Yeah, and in those situations, I think it's always best to move on, don't you? Don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I do it way before the fit. I mean, there are some kids that totally fall apart that are having fit after fit, and they usually have sensory issues. You know, there are usually some really valid things that are going on besides just being two. And, I'm not talking about normal kind of tantrumy stuff. I mean kids who are, again, really dysregulated.
Right.
But I move on with those kinds of kids way before they get to that point. You know, I would much rather find something that they want to do and that they're interested in and something that I can get them to stay engaged with me, because that's the only time that they're going to learn how to communicate and eventually how to talk.
Right.
When they're engaged and participating.
Right. And I think sometimes therapists fall into the trap of setting some arbitrary time limit, or
right,
you have to complete every piece of the puzzle,
yeah,
or you have, you know, and And really, in the end, it's really kind of irrelevant, I think. Not that, you know, completing a task isn't important, but, you know, we're dealing with very young children, and as far as I know, there's no official test that determines whether a child can put 8 pieces in as opposed to 9. You know, it's kind of like, well, wouldn't you rather have them do half and do it happily and do it willingly and, you know, communicate with you and it be a pleasant experience than the whole thing to the point where he's throwing the fit. But that's a common thing is, you know, sometimes therapists decide if you start it, you have to finish it. And I think you and I kind of feel like he'll get there.
Right.
And if you just keep things moving and pleasant, eventually he will learn that. I mean, it's just he may not be mature or capable of focusing that long, and you can't fix it in a day and making
right.
him mad to the point where he's kicking, screaming, crying, and throwing probably isn't going to help him get there any faster either. So
I don't think so either, because then I think that the next time that they see that toy or that activity, you almost can see their little bodies like, oh, my God, she is going to make me do this whole 10-piece puzzle, and there is no way that I want to do that. And so I let kids routinely do as much as I think we can do, and then maybe one more after that, and then we're done, and we move on to something else that's more fun for him and for me. Because I'm not having a good time when they're fussing either. I kind of like them happy.
No kidding.
I want them playing.
Yeah. I don't know how people get through a date having, I mean, if I have one session with the child that isn't optimal or isn't great, or gee, I accidentally made him mad and didn't see it coming, or he didn't
right.
say as much for me this week as he did last week, I'm kind of bummed for the rest of the day. I can't even imagine if half your kids or whatever percentage of the kids you saw just flat out didn't like you. You know,
I could do it all day. There's no way I could do it all day. And I'm like you. I would be totally upset by that. But I think that's one thing that we do is really analyze, okay, as an adult, what was my part in this situation? What cue did I not read from him
right.
that I should have picked up on 2 minutes before when we could have wrapped that up, still been happy, and then still moved on to something else that he would have happily done? And I'd much rather do that than spend the next 10 or 15 minutes trying to pull him out of that funk
right.
and pull him back into engaging with me. And I just think it's a lot easier to cut it off and let it end happily and then move on to something else happily than to try to fight a tantrum. Because you're not going to win.
No, yeah. I always say, you know, really, they pretty much, especially, you know, we go in for an hour or whatever amount of time and pretty much leave when we're supposed to, so then we know. And, you know, kids kind of seem to know that, too. Well, I'll just be mad and throw fits and not do this for the next hour, and gee, I kind of won the battle. So
right.
why would you? I don't know. It's just.
Well, I'm not into power. Yeah, and I'm not into power struggles with 2-year-olds.
No.
We have enough of that with our teenage children.
Yeah, we don't need that. We're the fun, more grandmotherly type therapists who like, or let me say,
don't
me.
Say grandmother!
I said more grandmotherly.
And I always bring that word up. I want to hear it. No.
See, my thing is, I only mean that because when you do get to go in and be fun, you know, when
absolutely.
You do get to go in and play with them and be that, you know, you get there and their eyes twinkle and they're either yelling your name or yelling whatever toy they want you to get out first, you know, you feel like Santa Claus. It's such a wonderful feeling to be that person. And I know you see this so much, because if I do, I know you do. But there's also kind of this thing like they know you get them,
right.
and they know you understand their frustration.
They totally do. And they
mm-hmm.
even look at you like,
thank
God, you're here. Somebody who knows me. Somebody who knows what I mean. Who knows
yeah.
I'm just not choosing not to talk. There's no way that I would not communicate if I could.
Right.
And I do think they look at you with those little faces, and they do get so excited. And we have a great job because we often are the highlight of a kid's week. And
mm-hmm.
there is nothing more rewarding to me than that, than to walk in and see them run to me or be excited about it, or the mom say, I told him you were coming, and he got so excited.
Yeah.
I know. It's a pretty good gig if you can get it, huh?
Yes. I would have to agree. It's a good job. Lots of fun.
I think so, too. All right. We're about 10 minutes over.
Oh, my. This is easy. We could do this.
Yeah, we like this every week, huh?
It's just kind of like our normal phone conversation.
What in the world? I know. Well, even though we went over 10 minutes, people can listen to this on the website. So I think that we will kind of air the whole thing and let people hear it. But anyway, we need to wrap it up for today.
Okay. Well, are we planning on doing this Friday afternoon at 12?
I think so, but we can talk about that off the air.
Okay.
Okay. So
all
that's
right.
All
talk to you soon.
Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. Bye.
Okay, bye.